Cartwright, and even into the first stanzas of that Wilding, she maintained the fool's hope that her gangster would save her, would appear out of the darkness with a gun and a reprieve. And when it became clear that no rescue was forthcoming, she fantasized in the instance of a blackout that he would visit her at the hospital, and there they would be married. He in a suit, she in a body cast. But then that too was revealed to be blepla by the sickening crack of her humerus, and now all that remained was the agony and the foolishness. In a blackout she caught sight of him, disappearing on that motorcycle again, felt the tightness in her chest as she screamed for him to wait. Wait! Saw for a brief instant La Inca praying in her room. The silence that lay between them now stronger than love. And in the gloaming of her dwindling strength, there yawned a loneliness so total it was beyond death. A loneliness that obliterated all memory. The loneliness of a childhood where she'd not even had her own name. And it was into that loneliness that she was sliding. And it was here that she would dwell forever, alone, black, fair, scratching at the dust with a stick, pretending that the scribble was letters, words, names. All hope was gone. But then, true believers, like the hand of the ancestors themselves, a miracle. Just as our girl was set to disappear across that event horizon, just as the cold of obliteration was stealing up her legs, she found in herself one last reservoir of strength. Her Cabral Magis. And all she had to do was realize that once again she'd been tricked. Once again she'd been played by the gangster. By Santo Domingo. By her own dumb needs to ignite it. Like Superman in Dark Knight Returns, who drained from an entire jungle the photonic energy he needed to survive Coldbringer? So did our Belly resolve out of her anger her own survival. In other words, her coraje saved her life. Like a white light in her. Like a sun. She came to in the ferocious moonlight. A broken girl atop broken stalks of cane. Pain everywhere but alive. Alive. And now we arrive at the strangest part of our tale. Whether what follows was a figment of Belly's racked imagination or something else altogether, I cannot say. Even your watcher has his silences, his páginas en blanco. Beyond the source wall, few have ventured. But no matter what the truth, remember, Dominicans are Caribbean and therefore have an extraordinary tolerance for extreme phenomena. How else could we have survived what we have survived? So as Belly was flitting in and out of life, there appeared at her side a creature that would have been an amiable mongoose if not for its golden lion eyes and the absolute black of its pelt. This was one quite large for its species, and placed its intelligent little paws on her chest and stared down at her.
"You have to rise, my baby," Belly wept. "Mi hijo precioso." "Ipatia, your baby is dead."
"No, no, 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 no."
It pulled at her unbroken arm.
"You have to rise now. Or you'll never have the son or the daughter."
"What son?" she wailed. "What daughter?"
"The ones who await."
It was dark and her legs trembled beneath her like smoke.
"You have to follow."
It rivered into the cane, and Belly, blinking tears, realized she had no idea which way was out. As some of you know, cane fields are no fucking joke, and even the cleverest of adults can get mazed in their endlessness, only to reappear months later as a cameo of bones. But before Belly lost hope, she heard the creature's voice. She, for it had a woman's lilt, was singing. in an accent she could not place, maybe Venezuelan, maybe Colombian.
Sueño, 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 ¿cómo tú te llamas?
She clung unsteadily to the cane, like an anciano clinging to a hammock, and, panting, took her first step, a long dizzy spell, beating back a blackout, and then her next. Precarious progress. Because if she fell, she knew she would never stand again. Sometimes she saw the creature's shebeen eyes flashing through the stalks.
Yo me llamo Sueño de la Madrugada.
The cane didn't want her to leave, of course. It slashed at her palms, jabbed into her flank, and clawed her thighs, and its sweet stench clogged her throat. Each time she thought she would fall, she concentrated on the faces of her promised future, her promised children, and from that obtained the strength she needed to continue. She pulled from strength, from hope, from hate, from her invincible heart, each a different piston driving her forward. Finally, when all were exhausted, when she began to stumble headfirst, heading down like a boxer on his last legs, she stretched her uninjured arm out, and what greeted her was not Cain, but the open world of life. She felt the tarmac under her bare, broken feet, and the wind. The wind. But she had only a second to savor it. For just then, an unelectrified truck burst out of the darkness in a roar of gears. What a life, she mused. All that lucha only to be run over like a dog. But she wasn't flattened. The driver, who later swore he saw something lion-like in the gloom, with eyes like terrible amber lamps, slammed on the brakes and halted inches from where a naked, blood-spattered belly tottered. Now check it. The truck held a perico ripiao conjunto, fresh from playing a wedding in Ocoa. Took all the courage they had not to pop the truck in reverse and peel out of there. Cries of, Itse baka! E si guapa! No! A Haitiano! Silenced by the lead singer, who shouted, It's a girl! The band members lay belly among their instruments, swaddled her with their chacabanas, and washed her face with the water they carried for the radiator and for cutting down the clarín. Down the band peered, rubbing their lips and running nervous hands through thinning hair. What do you think happened? I think she was attacked.
By a lion, offered the driver.
Maybe she fell out of a car.
It looks like she fell under a car.
Trujillo, she whispered.
Aghast, the band looked at one another.
We should leave her.
The guitarrista agreed.
She must be a subversive. If they find her with us, the police will kill us too.
Put her back on the road, begged the driver.
Let the lion finish her.
Silence. And then the lead singer lit a match and held it in the air, and in that splinter of light was revealed a blunt-featured woman with the golden eyes of a shebeen. We're not leaving her, the lead singer said in a curious Cibaeña accent. And only then did Belly understand that she was saved. The mongoose, one of the great unstable particles of the universe, and also one of its greatest travelers, accompanied humanity out of Africa, and after a long furlough in India, jumped ship to the other India, aka the Caribbean. Since its earliest appearance in the written record, 675 BCE, in a nameless scribe's letter to Ashurbanipal's father Esarhaddon. The mongoose has proven itself to be an enemy of kingly chariots, chains, and hierarchies, believed to be an ally of man. Many watchers suspect that the mongoose arrived to our world from another, but to date, no evidence of such a migration has been unearthed. Fukul versus Safa. There are still many, on and off the island, who offer Beli's near-fatal beating as irrefutable proof that the House Cabral was indeed victim of a high-level Fuku, the local version of House Atreus. Two Trujillos in one lifetime. What in carajo else could it be? But other heads question that logic, arguing that Beli's survival must be evidence to the contrary. Cursed people, after all, tend not to drag themselves out of cane fields with a frightening roster of injuries, and then happen to be picked up by a van of sympathetic musicians in the middle of the night who ferry them home without delay to a mother with mad connections in the medical community. If these serendipities signify anything, say these heads, it is that our Beli was blessed. What about the dead son? The world is full of tragedies enough without niggers having to resort to curses for explanations. A conclusion La Inca wouldn't have argued with. To her dying day, she believed that Beli had met not a curse, but God out in that cane field. I met something, Beli would say, guardedly. Back among the living. Touch and go, I tell you, unto the fifth day. And when at last she returned to consciousness, she did so screaming. Her arm felt like it had been pinched off at the elbow by a grindstone. Her head crowned in a burning hoop of brass. Her lung like the exploded carcass of a piñata. Jesucristo! She started crying almost immediately. But what our girl didn't know was that for the last half week, two of the best doctors in Bani had tended her covertly. Friends of La Inca and anti-Trujillo to the core, they set her arm and plastered it, stitched shut the frightening gashes on her scalp, 60 puntos in all, doused her wounds with enough mercurochrome to disinfect an army, injected her with morphine and against tetanus. Many late nights of worry, but the worst, it seemed, was over. These doctors, with a spiritual assist from La Inca's Bible group, had performed a miracle, and all that remained was the healing. She is lucky that she is so strong, the doctors said, packing their stethoscopes. The hand of God is upon her, the prayer leaders confirmed, stowing their Bibles. But blessed was not what our girl felt. After a couple of minutes of hysterical sobbing, of readjusting to the fact of the bed, to the fact of her life, she lowed out La Inca's name. From the side of the bed, the quiet voice of the benefactor. Don't talk, unless it's to thank the Savior for your life.
Mama! Beli cried. Mama! They killed my bebe. They tried to kill me.
And they did not succeed, La Inca said. Not for lack of trying, though.
She put her hand on the girl's forehead.
Now it's time for you to be quiet, for you to be still. That night was a late medieval ordeal.
Beli alternated from quiet weeping to gusts of rabia so fierce they threatened to throw her out of bed and reopen her injuries. Like a woman possessed, she drove herself into her mattress, went as rigid as a board, flailed her good arm around, beat her legs, spit and cursed. She wailed despite a punctured lung and cracked ribs. She wailed inconsolably.
Mama, me mataron a mi hijo. Estoy sola. Estoy sola.
Sola. La Inca leaned close.
Would you like me to call your gangster?
No,
she whispered. La Inca gazed down at her. I wouldn't call him either. That night, Beli drifted on a vast ocean of loneliness, buffeted by squalls of despair, and during one of her intermittent sleeps, she dreamt that she had truly and permanently died. and she and her child shared a coffin, and when she finally awoke for good, night had broken, and out in the street a grate of grief, unlike any she'd encountered before, was being uncoiled. A cacophony of wails that seemed to have torn free from the cracked soul of humanity itself. Like a funeral song for the entire planet.
Mama!
She gasped.
Mama! Mama!
Tranquilízate, muchacha. Mama, is that for me? Am I dying? Dime, mama.
Ay, hija, no seas ridícula.
La Inca put her hands, awkward hyphens, around the girl, lowered her mouth to her ear.
It's Trujillo.
Gunned down, she whispered. The night belly had been kidnapped. No one knows anything yet, except that he's dead. They say he was on his way for some ass that night. Who's surprised? A consummate culocrat to the end. Perhaps on that last night El Jefe sprawled in the back of his Bel Air, thought only of the routine pussy that was awaiting him at Estancia Fundación. Perhaps he thought of nothing. Who can know? In any event, there's a black Chevrolet fast approaching, like death itself, packed to the rim with U.S.-backed assassins of the higher classes. And now both cars are nearing the city limits, where the streetlights end. For modernity indeed has its limits in Santo Domingo. And in the dark distance looms the cattle fairgrounds where 17 months before some other youth had intended to assassinate him. El Jefe asks his driver Zacarias to turn on the radio, but, how appropriate, there is a poetry reading on and off it goes again. Maybe the poetry reminds him of Galíndez. Maybe not. The black Chevy flashes its lights innocuously, asking to pass, and Zacarias, thinking it's the secret police, obliges by slowing down. And when the cars come abreast, the escopeta wielded by Antonio de la Maza, whose brother, surprise, surprise, was killed in the Galíndez cover-up, which goes to show that you should always be careful when killing nerds. Never know who will come after you. Goes booyah! And now, so goes the legend, El Jefe cries, ¡Coño me hirieron! The second shotgun blast hits Zacarias in the shoulder, and he almost stops the car, in pain and shock and surprise. Hear now the famous exchange.
Get the guns, El Jefe says. Vamos a pelear. And Zacarias says, No jefe, son mucho. And El Jefe repeats himself, Vamos a pelear!
He could have ordered Zacarias to turn the car back to the safety of his capital, but instead, he goes out like Tony Montana. Staggers out of the bullet-ridden Bel Air, holding a .38 in his hand. The rest is, of course, history. And if this were a movie, you'd have to film it in John Woo slow motion. Shot at 27 times, what a Dominican number. And suffering from 400 hit points of damage. A mortally wounded Rafael Leonidas Trujillo Molina is said to have taken 2 steps toward his birthplace, San Cristobal, for as we know, all children, whether good or bad, eventually find their way home. But thinking better of it, he turned back toward La Capital, to his beloved city, and fell for the last time. Zacarias, who had his mid-parietal region creased by a round from a .357, got blown into the grass by the side of the road. Miracle of miracles, he would survive to tell the tale of the ajustamiento. De la Maza, perhaps thinking of his poor dead setup brother, then took Trujillo's .38 out of his dead hand and shot Trujillo in the face and uttered his now famous words.
Este guaraguao ya no comerá más pollito.
And then the assassin stashed El Jefe's body. Where? In the trunk, of course. And thus passed old fuckface. And thus passed the era of Trujillo. Sort of. I've been to the neck of the road where he was gunned down many, many times. Nothing to report except that the guagua from Aina, almost always runs my ass over every time I cross the highway. For a while, I hear, that stretch was the haunt of what El Jefe worried about the most. Los maricones.
La Inca in decline.
It's all true, plataneros. Through the numinous power of prayer, La Inca saved the girl's life, laid an A-plus safa on the Cabral family fuku. But at what cost to herself? Everybody in the neighborhood will tell you how, shortly after the girl slipped out of the country, La Inca began to diminish, like Galadriel after the temptation of the ring. Out of sadness for the girl's failure, some would say, but others would point to that night of Herculean prayer. No matter what your take, it cannot be denied that soon after Beli's departure, La Inca's hair began to turn a snowy white. And by the time Lola lived with her, she was no longer the great power she had been. Yes, she'd saved the girl's life, but to what end? Beli was still profoundly vulnerable. At the end of the Return of the King, Sauron's evil was taken by a great wind and neatly blown away, with no lasting consequences to our heroes. But Trujillo was too powerful, too toxic a radiation to be dispelled so easily. Even after death, his evil lingered. Within hours of El Jefe dancing bien pegado with those 27 bullets, his minions ran amok, fulfilling, as it were, his last will and vengeance. A great darkness descended on the island, and for the third time since the rise of Fidel, people were being rounded up by Trujillo's son Ramfis, and a good plenty were sacrificed in the most depraved fashion imaginable. The orgy of terror, funeral goods for the father from the son. Even a woman as potent as La Inca, who with the elvish ring of her will had forged within Bani her own personal Lothlorien, knew that she could not protect the girl against a direct assault from the Eye. What was to keep the assassins from returning to finish what they'd started? After all, they'd killed the world-famous Mirabal sisters, who were of name. What was to stop them from killing her poor orphaned Negrita? La Inca felt the danger palpably, intimately. And perhaps it was the strain of her final prayer. But each time La Inca glanced at the girl, she could swear that there was a shadow standing just behind her shoulder, which disappeared as soon as you tried to focus on it. A dark, horrible shadow that gripped her heart. And it seemed to be growing. La Inca needed to do something, so, not yet recovered from her Hail Mary play, she called upon her ancestors and upon Jesucristo for help. Once again she prayed. But on top of that, to show her devotion, she fasted. Pulled a Mother Abigail. Ate nothing but one orange. Drank nothing but water. After that last, vast expenditure of piety, her spirit was in an uproar. She didn't know what to do. She had a mind like a mongoose, but she was not in the end a worldly woman. She spoke to her friends who argued for sending Beli to the campo. She'll be safe there. She spoke to her priest. You should pray for her. On the third day, it came to her. She was dreaming that she and her dead husband were on the beach where he'd drowned. He was dark again, as he always was in summer. You have to send her away. But they'll find her in the campo. You have to send her to Nueva York. I have it on great authority that it is the only way. And then he strutted proudly into the water. She tried to call him back. Please come back! But he didn't listen. His otherworldly advice was too terrible to consider. Exiled to the north. To Nueva York. A city so foreign she herself had never had the ovaries to visit. The girl would be lost to her, and La Inca would have failed her great cause. To heal the wounds of the fall, to bring House Cabral back from the dead. And who knows what might happen to the girl among the Yankees? In her mind, the U.S. was nothing more and nothing less than a país overrun by gangsters, putas, and no-accounts. Its cities swarmed with machines and industry, as thick with sinvergüencería as Santo Domingo was with heat. A cuco shod in iron, exhaling fumes, with the glittering promise of coin deep in the cold, lightless shaft of its eyes. How La Inca wrestled with herself those long nights. But which side was Jacob, and which side was the angel? After all, who was to say that the Trujillos would remain in power much longer? Already, the necromantic power of El Jefe was waning, and in its place could be felt something like a wind. Rumors flew as thick as ciguas. Rumors that the Cubans were preparing to invade, that the Marines had been spotted on the horizon. Who could know what tomorrow would bring? Why send her beloved girl away? Why be hasty? La Inca found herself in practically the same predicament Beli's father had found himself in 16 years earlier. Back when the House of Cabral had first come up against the might of the Trujillos, trying to decide whether to act or to stay still. Unable to choose, she prayed for further guidance. Another 3 days without food. Who knows how it might have turned out had not the Elvises come calling. Our benefactor might have gone out exactly like Mother Abigail. But thankfully the Elvises surprised her as she was sweeping the front of the house. Is your name Miotis Toribio? They're pompadours like the backs of beetles, African muscles encased in pale summer suits, and underneath their jackets the hard oiled holsters of their firearms did creak. We want to speak to your daughter. Elvis One growled. Right now, Elvis Two added.
Por supuesto,
she said, and when she emerged from the house holding a machete, the Elvises retreated to their car laughing. Elvis One.
We'll be back, vieja.
Elvis Two.
Believe us.
Who was that?
Beli asked from her bed, her hands clutching at her non-existent stomach.
No one,
La Inca said, putting the machete next to the bed. The next night, no one shot a peephole clean through the front door of the house. The next couple of nights, she and the girl slept under the bed, and a little bit later in the week, she told the girl,
No matter what happens, I want you to remember. Your father was a doctor, and your mother was a nurse.
And finally the words, You should leave.
I want to leave. I hate this place.
The girl by this time could hobble to the latrine under her own power. She was much changed. During the day she would sit by the window in silence, very much like La Inca after her husband drowned. She didn't smile, she didn't laugh, she talked to no one, not even her friend Dorca. A dark veil had closed over her, like nata over café.
You don't understand, hija. You have to leave the country. They'll kill you if you don't.
Beli laughed.
Oh, Beli, not so rashly, not so rashly. What did you know about states or diasporas? What did you know about Nueva York, or unheated old law tenements, or children whose self-hate short-circuited their minds? What did you know, madam, about immigration? Don't laugh me, Negrita, for your world is about to be changed. Utterly.
Yes. A terrible beauty is, etc., etc. Take it from me. You laugh because you've been ransacked to the limit of your soul, because your lover betrayed you almost unto death, because your first son was never born. You laugh because you have no front teeth, and you've sworn never to smile again.
I wish I could say different,
but I've got it right here on tape. La Inca told you you had to leave the country and you laughed. End of story.
The last days of the Republic. She would remember little of the final months beyond her anguish and her despair, and her desire to see the gangster dead. She was in the grips of the darkness, passed through her days like a shade passes through life. She didn't move from the house unless forced. At last, they had the relationship La Inca had always longed for, except that they didn't speak. What was there to say? La Inca talked soberly about the trip north, but Belly felt like a good part of her had already disembarked. Santo Domingo was fading. The house, La Inca, the fried yuca she was putting into her mouth were already gone. It was only a matter of allowing the rest of the world to catch up. The only time she felt close to her old sense was when she spotted the Elvises lurking in the neighborhood. She would cry out in mortal fear, but they drove off with smirks on their faces. "We'll see you soon. Real soon." At night, there were nightmares of the cane, of the faceless one. But when she awoke from them, La Inca was always there. "Tranquila, hija. Tranquila." Regarding the Elvises, what stayed their hand? Perhaps it was the fear of retribution now that the Trujillato had fallen. Perhaps it was La Inca's power. Perhaps it was that force from the future reaching back to protect the third and final daughter. Who can know? La Inca, who I don't think slept a single day during those months. La Inca, who carried a machete with her everywhere. Homegirl was bout about it. Knew that when Gondolin falls, you don't wait around for the Balrogs to tap on your door. You make fucking moves. And make moves she did. Papers were assembled, palms were greased, and permissions secured. In another time, it would have been impossible. But with El Jefe dead and the Platano curtain shattered, all manner of escapes were now possible. La Inca gave Belly photos and letters from the woman she'd be staying with in a place called El Bronx. But none of it reached Belly. She ignored the pictures, left the letters unread, so that when she arrived at Idlewild, she wouldn't know who it was she would be looking for. La pobrecita. Just as the standoff between the good neighbor and what remained of family Trujillo reached the breaking point, Belly was brought before a judge. La Inca made her put hojas de mamón in her shoes so he wouldn't ask too many questions. Homegirl stood through the whole proceedings, numb, drifting. The week before, she and the gangster had finally managed to meet in one of the first love motels in the capital, the one run by Los Chinos, about which Luis Diaz sang his famous song. It was not the reunion she'd hoped for. "Ay, mi pobre negrita," he moaned, stroking her hair. Where once was lightning, now there was fat fingers on straight hair. "We were betrayed, you and I. Betrayed horribly." She tried to talk about the dead baby, but he waved the diminutive ghost away with a flick of his wrist and proceeded to remove her enormous breasts from the vast armature of her bra. "We'll have another one," he promised. "I'm going to have two," she said quietly. He laughed. "We'll have 50. The gangster still had a lot in his mind. He was worried about the fate of the Trujillato, worried that the Cubans were preparing to invade. "They shoot people like me in the show trials. I'll be the first person Che looks for."
"I'm thinking of going to Nueva York."
She had wanted him to say, "No, don't go," or at least to say he would be joining her. But he told her instead about one of his trips to Nueva York, a job for the jefe, and how the crab at some Cuban restaurant had made him sick. He didn't mention his wife, of course, and she didn't ask. It would have broken her. Later, when he started coming, she tried to hold on to him, but he wrenched free and came on the dark, ruined plane of her back. Like chalk on a blackboard, the gangster joked. She was still thinking about him 18 days later at the airport.
You don't have to go,
La Inca said suddenly, just before the girl stepped into the line. Too late.
I want to.
Her whole life she'd tried to be happy, but Santo Domingo, fucking Santo Domingo, had foiled her at every turn.
I never want to see it again.
Don't talk that way.
I never want to see it again.
She would be a new person, she vowed. They said no matter how far a mule travels, it can never come back a horse, but she would show them all.
Don't leave like this. Toma, for the trip. Dulce de coco.
On the line to passport control, she would throw it away, but for now, she held the jar.
Remember me. La Inca kissed and embraced her. Remember who you are. You are the third and final daughter of the family Cabral. You are the daughter of a doctor and a nurse.
Last sight of La Inca, waving at her with all her might, crying. More questions at passport control, and with a last contemptuous flurry of stamps, she was let through. And then the boarding, and the pre-flight chit-chat from the natty dude on her right, four rings in his hand. Where are you going? Never, never land, she snapped. And finally the plane, throbbing with engine song, tears itself from the surface of the earth, and Belly, not known for her piety, closed her eyes and begged the Lord to protect her. Poor Belly. Almost until the last, she half believed that the gangster was going to appear and save her.
I'm sorry, mi negrita. I'm so sorry. I should never have let you go.
She was still big on dreams of rescue. She'd looked for him everywhere. On the ride to the airport. In the faces of the officials checking passports. Even when the plane was boarding and finally, for an irrational moment, she thought he would emerge from the cockpit in a clean-pressed captain's uniform.
I tricked you, didn't I?
But the gangster never appeared again in the flesh. Only in her dreams. On the plane there were other first waivers. Many waters waiting to become a river. Here she is. Closer now to the mother we will need her to be if we want Oscar and Lola to be born. She is 16 and her skin is the darkness before the black, the plum of the day's last light. Her breasts like sunsets trapped beneath her skin. But for all her youth and beauty, she has a sour, distrusting expression that only dissolves under the weight of immense pleasure. Her dreams are spare, lack the propulsion of a mission. Her ambition is without traction. Her fiercest hope? That she will find a man. What she doesn't yet know. The cold. The back-breaking drudgery of the factorias. The loneliness of diaspora. That she will never again live in Santo Domingo. Her own heart. What else she doesn't know. That the man next to her would end up being her husband and the father of her two children. That after 2 years together he would leave her. Her third and final heartbreak. And she would never love again. She awakened just as in her dreams some ciegos were boarding a bus, begging for money. A dream from her lost days. The guapo in the seat next to her tapped her elbow.
Señorita, this is not something you'll want to miss.
I've already seen it, she snapped. And then, calming herself, she peered out the window. It was night, and the lights of Nueva York were everywhere. Chapter 4. Sentimental Education. 1988, to 1992. It started with me. The year before Oscar fell, I suffered some nuttiness of my own. I got jumped as I was walking home from the Roxy, by this mess of New Brunswick townies. A bunch of fucking morenos. 2 a.m. and I was on Joyce Kilmer for no good reason. Alone and on foot. Why? Because I was hard, thought I'd have no problem walking through the thicket of young guns I saw in the corner. Big mistake. Remember the smile on this one dude's face the rest of my fucking life. Only second to his high school ring, which plowed a nice furrow into my cheek, still got the scar. Wish I could say I went down swinging, but these cats just laid me out. If it hadn't been for some Samaritan driving by, the motherfuckers probably would have killed me. The old guy wanted to take me to Robert Wood Johnson, but I didn't have no medical, and besides, ever since my brother had died of leukemia, I hadn't been hot on doctors. So, of course, I was like, no, no, no. For having just gotten my ass kicked, I actually felt pretty good. Until the next day, when I felt like I had died. So dizzy, couldn't stand up without puking. My guts feeling like they'd been taken out of me, beaten with mallets and then reattached with paper clips. It was pretty bad. And of all the friends I had, all my great, wonderful friends, only Lola came fucking through. Heard about the beatdown from my boy Melvin, and shot over ASAP. Never so happy to see someone my whole life. Lola, with her big innocent teeth. Lola, who actually cried when she saw the state I was in. She was the one who took care of my sorry ass. Cooked, cleaned, picked up my classwork, got me medicine, even made sure that I showered. In other words, sewed my balls back on. And not any woman can do that for a guy, believe you me. I could barely stand, my head hurt so bad, but she would wash my back. And that was what I remember most about that mess. Her hand on that sponge, and that sponge on me. Even though I had a girlfriend, it was Lola who spent those nights with me, combing her hair out once, twice, thrice, before folding her long self into bed. No more night walking, okay, Kung Fu? At college, you're not supposed to care about anything. You're just supposed to fuck around, but believe it or not, I cared about Lola. She was a girl it was easy to care about. Lola, like the fucking opposite of the girls I usually macked on. Bitch was almost 6 feet tall and no tetas at all, and darker than your darkest grandma. Like two girls in one. The skinniest upper body married to a pair of Cadillac hips and an ill donkey. One of those overachiever chicks who run all the organizations in college and wear suits to meetings. Was the president of her sorority, the head of salsa, and co-chair of Take Back the Night. Spoke perfect, stuck-up Spanish. Known each other since pre-fresh weekend. But it wasn't until sophomore year, when her mother got sick again, that we had our fling. Drive me home, Junior, was her opening line. And a week later it jumped off. I remember she was wearing a pair of Douglas sweats and a Tribe t-shirt. Took off the ring her boy had given her and then kissed me. Dark eyes never leaving mine. You have great lips, she said. How do you forget a girl like that? Only 3 fucking nights before she got all guilty about the boyfriend and put an end to it. And when Lola puts an end to something, she puts an end to it hard. Even those nights after I got jumped, she wouldn't let me steal on her ass for nothing. So you can sleep in my bed, but you can't sleep with me? Yo soy prieta, Juni, she said, pero no soy bruta. Knew exactly what kind of sucio I was. 2 days after we broke up, saw me hitting on one of her lion sisters, and turned her long back to me. Point is, when her brother lapsed into that killer depression at the end of sophomore year, drank 2 bottles of 151 because some girl dissed him, almost fucking killing himself and his sick mother in the process, who do you think stepped up? Me. Surprised the shit out of Lola when I said I'd live with him the next year. Keep an eye on the fucking dork for you. After the suicide drama, nobody in Demarest wanted a room with homeboy. Was going to have to spend junior year by himself. No Lola either, because she was slotted to go abroad to Spain for that year. Her big fucking dream finally come true, and she was worried shitless about him. Knocked Lola for a loop when I said I'd do it. But it almost killed her dead when I actually did it. Move in with him. In fucking Demarest. Home of all the weirdos and losers and freaks and fembots. Me. A guy who could bench 340 pounds. Who used to call Demarest Homo Hall like it was nothing. Who never met a little white artist freak he didn't want to smack around. Put in my application for the writing section, and by the beginning of September, there we were. Me and Oscar. Together. I liked to play it up as complete philanthropy, but that's not exactly true. Sure, I wanted to help Lola out, watch out for her crazy-ass brother, knew he was the only thing she really loved in this world. But I was also taking care of my own damn self. That year, I'd pulled what was probably the lowest number in the history of the housing lottery. Was officially the last name on the waiting list, which meant my chances for university housing were zilch to none, which meant that my brokenness was either going to have to live at home or on the street, which meant that Demarest, for all its freakery, and Oscar, for all his unhappiness, didn't seem like so bad an option. It's not like he was a complete stranger. I mean, he was the brother of the girl I'd shadow-fucked. Saw him on campus with her those first couple of years. Hard to believe he and Lola were related. Me, Apocalypse, he cracked. She, New Genesis. Unlike me, who would have hidden from a Caliban like that, she loved the dork. Invited him to parties and to her rallies. Holding up signs, handing out flyers. Her fat-ass assistant. To say I'd never in my life met a Dominican like him would be to put it mildly. Hail, dog of God, was how he welcomed me my first day in Demarest. Took a week before I figured out what the hell he meant. God, Domini, dog, Canis. Hail, Dominicanus. I guess I should have fucking known. Dude used to say he was cursed. Used to say this a lot. And if I'd really been old-school Dominican, I would have A, listened to the idiot, and then B, run the other way. My family are Sureños from Asua, and if we Sureños from Asua know anything, it's about fucking curses. I mean, Jesus, have you ever seen Asua? My mom wouldn't even have listened, would have just run. She didn't fuck with Fukus or Guanguas. No way, no how. But I wasn't as old school as I am now. Just real fucking dumb. Assumed keeping an eye on somebody like Oscar wouldn't be no Herculean chore. I mean, shit, I was a weightlifter. Picked up bigger fucking piles than him every damn day. You can start the laugh track anytime you want. He seemed like the same to me. Still massive. Biggie Smalls minus the Smalls, and still lost. Still writing 10, 15, 20 pages a day. Still obsessed with his fanboy madness. Do you know what sign Fool put up on our dorm door? Speak, friend, and enter. In fucking Elvish. Please don't ask me how I knew this. Please. When I saw that, I said, De Leon, you gotta be kidding. Elvish? Actually, he coughed. It's Sindarin. Actually, Melvin said, it's gay hey hey. Despite my promises to Lola to watch out, those first couple weeks I didn't have much to do with him. I mean, what can I say? I was busy. What state school player isn't? I had my job and the gym and my boys and my novia, and of course I had my slutties. out so much that first month that what I saw of O was mostly a big dormant hump crashed out under a sheet. Only thing that kept his nerd ass up late were his role-playing games and his Japanese animation, especially Akira, which I think he must have watched at least 1,000 times that year. I can't tell you how many nights I came home and caught him parked in front of that movie. I'd bark, "You watching this shit again?" And Oscar would say, almost as if apologizing for his existence, "It's almost over." "It's always almost over," I complained. I didn't mind it, though. I like shit like Akira, even if I couldn't always stay awake for it. I'd lay back on my bed while Kaneda screamed, "Tetsuo!" And the next thing I knew, Oscar was standing timidly over me, saying, "Junior, the movie is finis." And I would sit up, say, "Fuck!" Wasn't half as bad as I made it out to be later. For all of his nerdiness, dude was a pretty considerate roommate. I never got stupid little notes from him like the last fucknuts I lived with. And he always paid for his half of shit, and if I ever came in during one of his Dungeons and Dragons games, he'd relocate to the lounge without even having to be asked. Akira, I could handle. Queen of the Demon Web Pits, I couldn't. Made my little gestures, of course. A meal once a week. Picked up his writings, 5 books to date, and tried to read some. Wasn't my cup of tea. "Drop the phaser, Arthurus Prime." But even I could tell he had chops. Could write dialogue, crack snappy exposition, keep the narrative moving. Showed him some of my fiction, too. All robberies and drug deals and "fuck you, Nando," and "blah, blah, blah." He gave me 4 pages of comments for an 8-page story. Did I try to help him with his girl situation? Share some of my playerly wisdom? Of course I did. Problem was, when it came to the mujeres, my roommate was like no one on the planet. On the one hand, he had the worst case of no-toto-itis I'd ever seen. The last person to even come close was this poor Salvadoran kid I knew in high school who was burned all over his face, couldn't get no girls ever because he looked like the Phantom of the Opera. Well, Oscar had it worse than him. At least Jeffrey could claim an honest medical condition. What could Oscar claim? That it was Sauron's fault? Dude weighed 307 pounds, for fuck's sake. Talked like a Star Trek computer. The real irony was that you never met a kid who wanted a girl so fucking bad. I mean, shit. I thought I was into females, but no one, and I mean no one, was into them the way Oscar was. To him, they were the beginning and end, the Alpha and the Omega, the DC and the Marvel. Holmes had it bad. Couldn't so much as see a cute girl without breaking into shakes. Developed crushes out of nothing. Must have had at least 2 dozen high-level ones that first semester alone. Not that any of these shits ever came to anything. How could they? Oscar's idea of G was to talk about role-playing games. How fucking crazy is that? My favorite was the day on the e-bus when he informed some hot morena, "If you were in my game, I would give you an 18 charisma." I tried to give advice, I really did. Nothing too complicated. Like, "Stop hollering at strange girls on the street." And, "Don't bring up the Beyonder any more than necessary." Did he listen? Of course not. Trying to talk sense to Oscar about girls was like trying to throw rocks at Eunice the Untouchable. Dude was impenetrable. He'd hear me out and then shrug. "Nothing else has any efficacy. I might as well be myself." "But your yourself sucks." "It is lamentably all I have." But my favorite conversation. "Junior?"
"What?"
"Are you awake?"
"If it's about Star Trek..."
"It's not about Star Trek." He coughed. "I have heard from a reliable source that no Dominican male has ever died a virgin. You who have experience in these matters, do you think this is true?" I sat up. Dude was peering at me in the dark, dead serious.
Oh?
It's against the laws of nature for a Dominicano to die without fucking at least once.
That,
he sighed,
is what worries me.
So what happens at the beginning of October? What always happens to playboys like me? I got bopped. No surprise, given how balls out I was living. Wasn't just any bop either. My girl Surian found out I was messing with one of the hermanas. Players, never, never, never fuck with a bitch named Awilda. Because when she Awildas out on your ass, you'll know pain for real. The Awilda in question dimed me for fuck knows what reason, actually taped one of my calls to her, and before you could say, oh shit, everybody knew. Homegirl must have played that thing like 500 times. Second time I'd been caught in 2 years, a record even for me. Suriyan went absolutely nuts. Attacked me on the e-bus. The boys laughing and running, and me pretending like I hadn't done anything. Suddenly I was in the dorm a lot, taking a stab at a story or two, watching some movies with Oscar, This Island Earth, Appleseed, Project A, casting around for a lifeline. What I should have done was check myself into booty rehab. But if you thought I was going to do that, then you don't know Dominican men. Instead of focusing on something hard and useful like, say, my own shit, I focused on something easy and redemptive. Out of nowhere, and not in the least influenced by my own shitty state, of course not, I decided that I was going to fix Oscar's life. One night while he was moaning on about his sorry existence, I said, "Do you really want to change it?" "Of course I do," he said, "but nothing I've tried has been ameliorative." "I'll change your life." Really? The look he gave me still breaks my heart even after all these years. Really? You have to listen to me, though. Oscar scrambled to his feet, placed his hand over his heart. "I swear an oath of obedience, my lord. When do we start?"
"You'll see."
The next morning, 6 a.m., I kicked Oscar's bed.
"What is it?"
he cried out.
"Nothing much,"
I said, throwing his sneakers on his stomach. "Just the first day of your life." I really must have been in a dangle over Surian, which is why I threw myself something serious into Project Oscar. Those first weeks, while I waited for Surian to forgive me, I had Fat Boy like Master Killer in Shaolin Temple, was on his ass 24/7. Got him to swear off the walking up to strange girls with his "I love you" craziness. You're only scaring the poor girls, oh? Got him to start watching his diet and to stop talking crazy negative. I am ill-fated. I am going to perish a virgin. I'm lacking in pulchritude. At least while I was around, I did. Positive thoughts, I stressed. Positive thoughts, motherfucker. Even brought him out with me and the boys. Not anything serious, just out for a drink when it was a crowd of us and his monstroness wouldn't show so much. The boys hatin'. What's next? We start inviting out the homeless? But my biggest coup of all? I got dude to exercise with me. To fucking run. Goes to show you, O really did look up to me. No one else could have gotten him to do that. The last time he'd tried running had been freshman year, when he'd been 50 pounds lighter. I can't lie. First couple of times I almost laughed, seeing him huffing down George Street, those ashy black knees of his a-shaking, keeping his head down so he wouldn't have to hear or see all the reactions. Usually just some cackles and a stray, "Hey, fat ass." The best one I heard, "Look, Mom. That guy's taking his planet out for a run." "Don't worry about them jokers," I told him.
No worry, he heaved.